Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, thank you for coming this evening. My name is Christopher Montgomery, and I'm editor of The Critic. We have come to Cambridge this evening because we're never sure in London whether our view is correct, whether the view of the universities we have there is quite as dreadful as some of our friends at the university make it out to be, not least in our own pages. So we have come here tonight for what necessarily had to be a secret event, because we're told that some of the views that some of the people here have here are not shared by everyone else at the university. The saddest thing for somebody like me is that 30 years ago, the one thing you could always do, even at Peterhouse, was disagree. We could disagree with one another, we could say unpleasant things to one another, and we'd do the same thing the next day. Nobody fell out over it. So the level of grudge-bearing that has entered into British intellectual life is the single most depressing aspect of my lifetime. And I'm an Ulsterman, so I'm used to people bearing grudges. So my colleague Graham Sturt in the middle, who's the deputy editor of the magazine, will introduce the panel in a second. Even by the standards of The Critic's masthead, which does lean slightly light blue, I think we've got Christ's, John's corpus. We have James Orr here this evening from Balliol to represent The Critic's view of diversity. So, and you'll have to make do with the panel you've got. We're very grateful that all of you have come this evening, and I hope that you enjoy it and that you hear disagreement. Thank you.
Monty, thank you, and Graham, thank you for putting all... You do want to say something, Graham? Were you introducing?
I wanted to introduce you.
You want to introduce me? Okay.
Well, the man who needs no introduction is Dr. James Orr. No, and I think to certainly to many of you who are at Cambridge or follow events at Cambridge, he is, of course, associate professor of the study of the philosophy of religion in our Divinity faculty here at Cambridge. And it's a great pleasure to ask him to speak first with a few introductory remarks.
Thank you, Graham, very much. Second time lucky. It's wonderful to be here. Huge thanks to Graham and to Monty and to the whole team at The Critic for assembling this rather subversive gathering of critic readers and writers in the... in Babylon, in the very belly of the beast. But it didn't used to be the belly of the beast. And we can see here there's Charles Darwin, and of course Christ is the College of Milton, two great figures who were ferocious in their fight for intellectual freedom and ferocious in their courage to test received wisdom and to challenge the intellectual climate of their age. And one wonders, of course, whether the university today is capable of forming future Miltons and future Darwins. I don't need to tell many of you here that there's scarcely a layer of the university, the modern university, and it's certainly true of Cambridge, I think, that isn't politicised in some way. It's easy to exaggerate it. It's very difficult one to sort of give an overall judgment when one just sees one's little spot of the coalface. But I think, generally speaking, there has been a very sharp... development in recent years at all sort of layers of the university, and thinking in particular of the politicisation of admissions. The brightest and best of our young students, if they are unlucky enough to apply from private schools, are finding it harder and harder to be treated fairly at admissions. Our brightest and best from state schools are finding it harder and harder to be treated fairly when it comes to being offered grades that are commensurate with those being offered to the rest of the world. As the Sunday Times revealed a few weeks ago, there's a very, very sharp disparities and probably unlawful disparities in the grade offers being offered to domestic and international students, as so many of our universities have decided to turn themselves into immigration agencies rather than what they should be, namely forming institutions our future citizens. At the appointment processes, the appointment level, appointment processes are managed to, my sense is, to ensure that the heterodox do not stand a chance of getting shortlisted. Some of us have stumbled into the Ivory Asylum, but it's mainly by accident, and there aren't many of us. And increasingly, there are increasingly perverse incentive structures when it comes to research, the sort of the engine room of the university. And more research is being refracted through a highly contentious and plainly political prisms of concerns that have little or nothing to do with the field of scholarly inquiry concerned. The main way that's done in Cambridge, by the way, is to centralise research and to provide a sort of shop window with all sorts of tempting baubles, offers to conferences, pecuniary incentives, offers for sort of lunches and media training from the university, whatever that looks like. The one in Cambridge, yes, it's the Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. Without any shadow of irony, that's CRASH. It is the acronym. And Oxford, not to be outdone, calls its shop window the Oxford Research Centre in the Humanities, or TORCH. And as a brief glance at their websites will demonstrate, crashing and torching the humanities is something they're extremely good at doing. Because once you can sort of pool and centralise research and provide this, set up these wonderful incentive structures, you can, of course, police the research and you can politicise it. It's been a while since I've doom-scrolled Crash's website, but I glanced at it this afternoon, so you don't have to let you know about some of the events this term. Here are four I've picked just at random to give you a sense of what's in the spotlight of cutting-edge research in the arts, social sciences and humanities at Cambridge this term. One, queer and trans philologies. Activism and science. What space is there in science for activism around the climate and biodiversity crises? Black town and gown, the historical legacy of black presence, capital B, of course, in the city of Cambridge. Alfred Dubs lecture, race, corporate sovereigns and corporate borders. Debordering futures, finally, racial capitalism, coloniality and migrant justice. None of these topics are in themselves illegitimate. Some of them may be very interesting indeed, but it's hard to escape the feeling that what's being debordered are the domains of activism on the one hand and academia on the other. Those of us on the inside of the Ivory Asylum are constantly buffeted by the latest schemes of activists, academics and administrators, and none of it makes any sense at all. Unconscious bias training that makes you more unconsciously biased, trigger warnings that are too triggering for students, anti-racist training that makes us more racist, or at least more racially conscious, diversity shakedowns that make us more divided, equality campaigns that create a hierarchy of this month's confected pyramid of victimhood groups, inclusion initiatives run by some of the most exclusive institutions in the world. I mean, our business model really is to exclude as many people as possible to make sure we are finding the brightest and best. And of course, they are inclusion initiatives designed to exclude all but the true believers. And as I said, none of this makes sense, but it's not supposed to. Propaganda is never meant to inform or to enlighten or to educate. Propaganda is there to humiliate. The more an ideology clashes with common sense, the greater the rupture with reality, the starker and more convincing the display of ideological power. It was hard enough for Winston Smith, who was a mid-level employee of the Ministry of Truth, to confess that, yes, 2 + 2 did equal 5. But it's especially humiliating for academics who have built their professional lives and understand their professional vocations as being grounded in intellectual integrity and honesty to have to confess or at least tacitly go along with absurdities. Enough doomsterism. There is plenty to be optimistic about, and I think we'll touch on that in our conversation later. But there are some seeds of hope on the horizon. Our now former colleague, sadly, Arif Ahmed, led a terrific campaign in 2020, of course. here in the university which really put into focus, cast into sharp relief, the nature of the problem. And that seems to have galvanised the government to push through the Freedom of Speech Higher Education Act that received royal assent last year. And the wheels of that act will start spinning on the 1st of August. And Arif is working extremely hard to make sure that that system is going to be can hit the ground running. So, and there are some even early signs before it's really up and running that the law itself, the law is a teacher, as Thomas Aquinas said, and it does seem to be having some downstream effects on the institutional behaviour of our university leaders already. And so that's something we should be encouraged by, and we can hope that there will be a thawing effect on the notorious chilling effect that we've had to cope with, deal with in these since the Cultural Revolution began 10 years ago or so. And they're also promising new forms of new bits of infrastructure opening up. Eric Kaufman's Centre of Heterodox Social Sciences at that great bunker, the University of Buckingham. There's the Pharos Initiative in Oxford, and we've got two of the leadership here today. And so there are some promising developments, and that these are sort of these are institutions or developments that are in the heart of the university, but crucially not controlled by the university. And that's something that we can hope to see more of in the future. And of course, there's you. There's this growing emerging ecosystem of slightly reactionary online platforms and magazines who aren't afraid to cut against the grain of the dominant orthodoxies of our age. There are Substacks, there are YouTube channels, there are long-form podcasts, and those academics like to turn their nose up at all of that, although they never turn down invitations when they are to appear on these shows. But those, I think, are extremely useful ways of getting the message out, getting sort of heterodox views, giving them some oxygen, and making them respectable enough for the universities not to be able to continue ignoring them. Thank you all very much. Look forward to discussion later on.
Thank you very much indeed, James. I'd now like to call for him to make his own introductory remarks. Dr. Milbeck, who is, amongst many other things, most proudly of all, executive editor of The Critic magazine.
Oh, thank you very much, Graham. We hear a lot, and with some justice, about the dominance of progressive ideology in the universities. You know, the sort of, you know, the fanaticism, the narrowing of speech. It's something we've all experienced, and we care about it, and we fight against it with good reason. But I think for those of us in academia or pushed to its periphery, there is an obligation to search deeper and ask why. You know, why has this taken over the university? Why do so many students pulled into it so quickly and with such fervour? And I think part of the answer lies with, you know, what Marx described religion as being the heart of a heartless world. And I think academia has become a heartless world. It's become so that behind all of the progressive rhetoric, there is a very cold, neoliberal, technocratic system that dominates modern academia. We see it in the administration, in the commercialisation, and the technocratisation of contemporary education. We're here to develop skills for the marketplace. We're here to contribute to economic growth. We're here to, sometimes it seems, give jobs to administrators who are here to tell us what to do. None of this is really satisfying. And I think all of us in this recent edition have been searching after a shared question. What ought a university to be? What is it for? And I think this essential question, you know, really calls us to think about where society in general wants a university to do. So, you know, what is it? Is it a playground for the idle young to undergo sort of hedonistic rites of passage? Is it a laboratory for economically productive research? Or just a sort of glorified Kafkaesque administration perpetually expanding into a void? Well, yeah, quite. Well, the we'll have that for. And of course, there's nothing wrong with, you know, training skilled workers, you know, with technical innovation, with administration even, or for that matter, hedonistic rites of passage. I think the problem comes when all of those things, which, you know, stop becoming means to sort of higher ends and become ends in themselves. So we've lost touch with the ultimate meaning and purpose of universities. And yet, that's a strange thing about universities. They're very, very old institutions. This one's 800 years old. And it's odd that universities, which, you know, for many are the focus of modernity, you know, the most modern institution, they're where science happens, they're where innovation happens, they're where progressive ideology happens, that behind modernity seems to have a medieval heart. You know, we still go to medieval colleges, we still go to services which have only changed in small ways over centuries. And it's strange that for all that no modern person would start where we are now, they still choose to start where people were 800 years ago. And people fight, you know, they crawl over each other, they compete brutally, they invent systems of diversity to try and get people into this place, into this system. And what we're talking about when we talk about a medieval institution is not merely a different set of ideas or a different place in time, but a different world. I mean, just to give a sense of the sort of what this world is, what it was, their understanding of knowledge was not data input into machines and outputted into brains. It was divine illumination, the first light of creation still shining through the thin skein of reality, a river of light passing through a veil of tears. Sight itself, the sort of the basic sense, was thought of as the light of the intellect pouring forth from the eye, investing everything it touched for coherence and meaning. Social scientists have described this way of seeing reality as a form of enchantment, but it might be described, in fact, as its opposite. The medieval world was supremely, almost supra-rational. Everything in it possessed significance and intentionality. Invisible intelligence has permeated this world. And I think it's this difference in worldview that begins to explain the exceptionality of inherited institutions. That my own college, Corpus Christi, was a guild dedicated to the body of Christ, you know, a metaphysical concept, and the Virgin Mary. And it's those ideas, this idea of a higher destiny of man, that made institutions work. And I think that sense of a kind of a source code that is still making things work even after we've lost its origin is a very powerful idea. And I think it speaks to a general loss of purpose and a civilizational moment. There's a sort of internal surrender, a vast loss of confidence and direction. But we're still persisting with these institutions that bear meanings that we no longer understand or recognise. And I think in the same way that that universities have also become the place, most of all, that undermine our sense now, our sense of purpose. They've become places where we have not only lost our sense of meaning, but have come to destroy it and undermine it. And I think there's also, in that sense, no better place to confront the crisis of purposelessness than the modern university. And I think in the modern university is also the place where we can rediscover that sense of original purpose and meaning. Thank you very much.
I thought we were going to have an encore there for a moment. Thank you very much indeed, Sebastian. I'm very keen now to get the student experience from a recent graduate. We're all graduates.
Round of applause, please.
Very well. It's a great pleasure to call Charlie Bentley-Aston, who recently graduated from St John's College.
Yeah, I needed that round of applause because it was. If it wasn't for the many people in this room, I almost certainly would have dropped out at several different junctures. So finishing my degree was perhaps the greatest achievement of my life. And but one I'm wondering if I regret on a daily basis. It's only for meeting the people in this room that I don't regret coming here. When I decided to apply to Cambridge, I was very small. I had been watching a documentary on the BBC, and there was this the image of the backs and voiceover talking about universities, these places where you can ask any question and you will be given an answer, and if there is no answer, well, together we will find one. And I come from a working class background, not to bring diversity into it, but this matters because the education that you get in a state school is very functional and bureaucratic. It is, you don't need to know that because it's not in the exam. And so this was an endless frustration of mine from a young age. I'd ask a question and the response would be either, you're too young, you don't need to know that, or it's not in the exam, so you don't need to know that. And so the idea that there was a place in which I could come and ask these questions and would receive an answer seemed like my idea of heaven. But because I came from a working class background and this is the attitude towards education, I didn't aspire to go to university. I'm a very practical person. I went into the arts and worked there for a very long time. It was only when I was sort of making progress there that the directors I were working with at one of the big theatres in London said to me, oh, you should go get a degree to forward your craft because we've taught you all we can practically. And I sort of rolled my eyes saying, oh, this is why I've come to you. I don't want to go to university. But I conceded and said, okay, which university should I go to? And they said, oh, well, we all went to Cambridge, so you should go to Cambridge. And so I thought, oh, yeah, I'll go to Cambridge. So I went to my school and I said, oh, I'm going to apply to Cambridge. And they laughed. My head of school laughed. And then he went, oh, you're being serious. And yeah. I say it with this very posh accent, but they don't have posh accents at all. And so it was a very, very long, hard process of chronic back and forth emails with Cambridge. I had to be sent off to one of the local private schools to be sort of tutored on what an entrance exam and interview even was, because my school didn't know how to apply. And so having overcome all of that, I finally thought, yes, I had made it to the place where I can ask any question and get an answer, and soon found out that in fact wasn't the case. And it still isn't the case, and this is a problem. And so I took David's, I didn't know we had to write speeches, and so this is why I'm riffing personal experience, which David decries in his own essay, rightly so. But I took his questions very seriously. He said, what is my piece about, and why does my piece matter? So I'm going to answer those two questions for you. So what is my piece about? It's about the prevalence of self-censorship in the universities and the steps that are being taken to counteract suppression of free speech. This is namely through, I argue, the formation and emergence of secret societies and exclusive salons within the universities, like this one, that are invite only with Chatham House rules. In this piece, I sketch out how it was that I ended up finding and becoming involved with these secret societies and what goes on in these secret societies. But it is only a sketch. It is vague because these societies, for the time being at least, still need protection and anonymity. So why does my piece matter? Well, I touch upon it in my statement that for someone who had no prospects and thought I had one in Cambridge, to find out it's not quite the place I thought it was, matters to people who don't have much upward mobility. But why does my piece matter? It's because people within the universities and the general public more broadly do not know what students and academics put themselves through to keep academic freedom alive and preserve our history, namely from the deconstructionists. The students and academics that are attempting to preserve academic freedom, the freedom of conversation, the freedom to meet and discuss, these are the heroes of our time. To put the situation into context, 2/3 of students self-censor at least one major political issue. Yet, 80% of students say that they have the freedom to speak at university. So that is a 65% of students believe they do not have the freedom to speak, and the same 65 students do believe they have the freedom to speak. And so for the quick-witted among you, you'll realise that this is a problem. We also know that right-wing students self-censor twice as much as left-wing students at a rate of almost 70%. And when I asked Cambridge students on an anonymous online chat room, CamFest, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, I asked if this was an acceptable state of affairs, that 70% of their right-wing peers couldn't say what they thought, couldn't say what they believed to be true. The responses were that this is a mark of progress and that we need to work together to ensure the number of right-wing students who self-censor gets up to 100%. and this was followed by a handshake emoji if you needed extra sardonic taunt thrown in there. This piece matters because the general public need to understand that there is a conspiracy on the left to shut up the right. And the conspiracy is run by students, and it is aided and abetted by academics, be they malicious or simply suffering from a mild case of cowardice. The university needs to understand that there are groups of us who will not take this censorship, this restricted freedom, lying down. They'll have to bloody catch us first. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlie. And finally, to give his thoughts, I'd very much like to call Senior Lecturer in Classics at Cambridge University, Dr. David Butterfield.
Well, good evening, everyone. What a pleasure it is to be here. A real thrill to have such not necessarily like-minded group of people in the room, but a group of people who are concerned about one of the fundamental issues of our day. And while it was something of an acutely bittersweet pleasure to write my piece for The Issue, of which you can get a copy as you leave if you're not already a signed-up subscriber, it's actually a real pleasure for me to be airing my concerns here in Christ's. Because Christ's, to me, is not just any college in Cambridge. It so happens that 21 years ago, and roughly 21 metres that way, my first experience of Cambridge life occurred, because I was an undergraduate here, just in the corridor next door, and it was, as Charlie just set out, a transformational moment, at least on paper, for me. As I say, I've been here the best part of two decades now, but the close of my article in that magazine has a coda, which means it won't be for too much longer. But Christ is an extremely apposite place to talk about problems within not just the university sector, but within Cambridge. If we go back to the founder of Christ, Lady Margaret Beaufort, she had very firm opinions about what good scholarship and bad scholarship looked like. 400 years ago, with Milton had an awful time at Christ's, I'm sorry to say. The curriculum was uninspiring, it straitjacketed his genius, and he was only too happy to escape back to London. 200 years ago, we have the man Darwin. Darwin proudly said that he wasted his undergraduate years at Christ's, instead shooting and collecting beetles before scuttling off on the Beagle. If we get into the 20th century, even then, Christ's academics have problems to air. If we think in the 1950s of C.P. Snow was a fellow here, he went over to the Senate House here in Cambridge and announced in consternation that two cultures were emerging, that the sciences and the humanities were not just spreading apart, which may be a natural feature of academic evolution, but they were no longer mutually intelligible. Neither side could converse with the other. And a few years after that, Sir J.H. Plum, Jack Plum, also a student and fellow here at Christ's, wrote a book in the 1960s called The Crisis of the Humanities. Now, that title, though 60 years old, is extremely cliched. The Crisis of the Humanities is something that comes up every year, and were you to Google it, you would find a plethora of articles. So it was with some regret that my own piece in this university's special was also about problems in the humanities, and it was under the title Hollowed Out Humanities. And for the next few minutes, I'd just like to sketch out some of the problems which I see as extremely dangerous to the future of the humanities. Now, the crucial point that I try to make is that it is not correct to blame the problems on external forces. So if you do Google the title I mentioned, Crisis of the Humanities, what will you find? You will find the lamentation that funding is decreasing, and it may even be Brexit-related. You will find the government being obstructive, either directly through law or indirectly through the Office for Students, somehow constraining what the humanities can do. You will find criticism that tuition fees has made life harder in the humanities. You will find claims that the raw number of humanities students is decreasing, and that's entirely true. There are 50,000 fewer humanities students now than there were 15 years ago. The humanities are on a legitimate decline, a real decline. you will find people moving the problem into the school sector and saying, well, the fact is, the educational system and the teachers aren't preparing people to take the A-levels that would allow them to enter the university sector. And all of those things are entirely true, but they're all external, are they not, to the university proper. If we go inside the university to try and gauge what the problems are in the humanities, the standard media narrative would be that the students are the problem. There they are, turning up, paying their fees as though they're customers, and expecting to get what they want, not for the tradition of the humanities to be preserved. But that's a massively overstated case, and I think it's wrong in this particular score to blame students for the decline in the humanities. So what do I mean then when I talk about hollowed out humanities and internal endemic problems within the university sector? I mean two things, and both are such significant problems that I think they are genuinely insoluble for a generation. I'm sorry to be pessimistic, and I hope in our discussion we have a more optimistic take, but let me explain what I mean. I mean the twin problem of the academic sector within the humanities, and by that I do mean my general colleagues in the broader world of academia, not my immediate colleagues necessarily, and the administrative sector, which in various ways is in cahoots with the problems in academia. Now, it might seem rather strange to say that the humanities are struggling within the universities. They've always been there. They're the lifeblood of the university sector, are they not? No, they're not. If we go back to the medieval university, as Sebastian mentioned very eloquently and somewhat romantically, albeit truthfully, when universities are founded in the 11th century, they're aimed at theology, medicine, and law. And to get there, you've got to go through your linguistic trivium of grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. Then you've got to do your mathematical quadrivium of geometry, arithmetic, astronomy, and music. And then you get to one of those three really rather vocational modes of study, theology, medicine, and law. Where in that is literature? Where are the classics? Where is the broader sense of the humanities as we know them? The answer is that only emerges with the Renaissance, with the idea of humanism. And what is humanism? Well, it's clearly what gives the humanities its beating heart, but we can't understand that without going back to humanism. It's a very simple set of claims, humanism. It's that although there are societally dependent and contingent issues which make one culture different from one another, nevertheless, the human condition at large is something that universally can be experienced and understood by anyone in the world. Okay, so there's nothing that is ethnocentric in any way, nor politically aligned. It's a universalizing claim about the human condition. Now, I'm a classicist, and it's often claimed that classics is part of the problem in politicizing the humanities because it focuses so much on the Greeks and the Romans, who were indeed particular people in a particular place at a particular time. How can it be right to have the lifeblood of the Renaissance and the humanities being so specific in time and place? Well, the answer is the Greeks and the Romans were not of extreme interest to the Renaissance humanists and to subsequent evolutions of the university sector because they were Greeks and Romans or because they were the forerunners of us. The fact was they had sufficient material surviving from antiquity that allowed people to understand in the 14th and 15th century how they, in Europe, got to where they were. And it was a moment of realization that the European traditions, the cultural norms, were a mixture of the Judeo-Christian unbroken thread interwoven with the Greco-Roman thread that shaped Europe. Now, I fully accept that that narrative is Europe-specific, but for the humanities, it is not meant in any sense to be tied geographically. Because once people could see that immersing oneself in different cultures, in their art, in their literature, in their history, could allow for exploration of the enduring and major insoluble questions about the human condition, that created the space for a totalizing study of the humanities.
So the humanities are open-ended. The various subjects, the various schools that exist in the university cover a remarkable degree of subjects. So where is the problem? If the humanities are open to all, what am I going on about? Sadly, it comes down to what's been touched upon a couple of times already. A crisis of purpose and a lack of confidence, a lack of faith in what the humanities are. The things I just described, and perhaps in your mind you thought they were controversial, perhaps they are. Those things I just described are no longer regarded as universalizing claims. Instead, they are Western-centric claims which promote a certain view of the human condition over others. As such, it follows for most of my colleagues' outlook on the humanities that we can't continue with this open book approach to these subjects in the way that was taken for granted. And once you start believing those particular contentions, and once you start believing that there isn't a societal importance to immerse yourself in the humanities, very quickly, this set of subjects becomes unmoored and cut loose. And two things have happened, and I'll end with these two provocations for our discussion to follow. The first is that the administrative side don't know what on earth to do with the humanities. They're trained in science, they're trained in tech, and they're told to measure things, to measure employability, to measure impact on society, to measure wages, stuff that you can put numbers on. Well, I'm sorry, there's nothing intrinsic to the humanities that allows any meaning, numerical quantification. But that's their job, so they drag and impose that set of criteria on a set of subjects that simply can't handle it. So we are confronted with a series of bureaucratic desires and claims and pushes which actually make no sense for the tradition of the humanities. And the second is that a minority, but a very active and a very energetic minority of humanities academics, need to find meaning in their own work. And that's not the traditional meaning of pushing forward research and getting closer to some notion of truth. No, for the great majority of these people, there is no truth to get at. And the payoff of being a successful humanities scholar is to be societally active, to make a difference outside the university sector. What happens very quickly, therefore, as you can fully understand, is not just the politicisation of the study of the humanities, but actually it's contemporary activist focus. And it's no surprise that that skews in one direction very particularly on the left-right spectrum, and as such closes down not counter-right-wing attempts at doing the humanities, which I think are not a good idea within the university sector, but it blocks any claim of this grander narrative of universal, not rooted to time or place, exploration of the human condition. But it helps the academics that the administration need things to happen, and it helps the administrative staff that the academics are prepared to play their game in cahoots. So these issues may come up in what we have to talk about now, and hopefully you'll be preparing your questions, but I'll leave it there from me. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.